You've got it backward. Get your car out of my way. For a split second, Turlock looked surprised. Then his expression settled back into a menacing lack of any expression at all. His voice was flat. You're making a mistake. Look around you. Gurney gestured up and down the block where several residents had come out into the street, holding up their smartphones and other devices. They're recording everything that's happening. Right now they're recording your car blocking my car. Images everything, right? Gurney flashed a humorless smile. Turlock's reply was a dead stare. Some messages have a huge impact, said Gurney, glancing at his car windows to make sure they were closed and the woman inside wouldn't hear him. So imagine this message on every news site tomorrow morning. Deputy police chief stands between pregnant wife and dying husband. You think that's the kind of message your boss has in mind? Think fast, your career is circling the drain. Turlock's mouth twitched into a hint of an ugly smile. Okay, he whispered. We'll do it your way, for now. He gestured to his driver, who moved the Explorer just far enough to allow Gurney room to turn around and head for Mercy Hospital. With the help of his GPS, Gurney soon had the hospital in sight at the end of a long avenue, which seemed to calm his passenger just a little. He took the opportunity to ask if she'd actually seen what had happened. Her voice was shaky. He'd just gone out the front door. I heard a sound, like a rock hitting the house. I looked out. She bit her lip and fell silent. He assumed that what sounded like a rock was the impact of the bullet that had passed through the side of her husband's head. He asked, "Do you know what a gunshot sounds like?" "Yes." "Did you hear anything at all like that?" "No." "When you came out, did you see anyone? A car driving away? Any movement at all?" She shook her head. When they arrived at the hospital, the EMTs already had the stretcher out of the ambulance and were rolling it toward the open doors of the emergency entrance. As Gurney brought the Outback to a halt beside the ambulance, his passenger was already stepping out the door. Abruptly, she stopped and turned toward him. "Thank you for what you did back there," she said. "Thank you so much. I don't even know your name." "Dave Gurney. I hope your husband will be all right." "Oh, my God." Her hand went to her mouth, her eyes widening.
"What? What is it?"
"You're the person Rick was on his way to meet." 23. Heather Loomis's frantic need to follow her husband into the hospital prevented any discussion of the unsettling revelation. Gurney decided that sitting there would be a waste of time and would risk another confrontation with Turlock, who would likely be coming to the hospital to interview Heather. It would make more sense to return to the crime scene, which Klein had asked him to observe. He retraced his route and was soon back on Oak Street. Clusters of curious neighbors were still in front of their homes. There was no sign of Turlock or his blue Explorer, and only one of the five police cruisers was still there, its lights no longer flashing. On the far side of the cruiser there was a black Ford Crown Victoria, the most common unmarked police vehicle in America. In the driveway there was a gray van with a WRPD logo on its door. Gurney parked next to the cruiser. Yellow crime scene tape extended from one corner of the house to a series of metal stakes, about 20 feet out on the lawn, and back to the far corner of the house. An evidence tech was standing in a flower bed next to the front door. He was probing a hole in the wood trim with a bright metal tool that looked like a surgeon's pliers. He was wearing the latex gloves and Tyvek coveralls common to his occupation. Gurney got out of his car, credentials in hand, and was heading across the lawn toward the taped-off area when he was stopped by a familiar voice. "Hey, Dave, over here." He turned around and saw Mark Torres gesturing with his phone through the open window of the Crown Vic. He walked over and waited until Torres concluded his call. Getting out of the car, the young detective looked concerned. "I was afraid I'd missed you. Was there a problem here after the shooting?" Gurney shrugged. "Nothing major. Heather Loomis wanted to be with her husband. It could have been her last chance to see him alive, so I took her." "Ah, that makes sense." Torres looked relieved, but not entirely so. "Where's Turlock?" "I don't know. I was at headquarters. He told me to get over here and find the location used by the BDA sniper." "The BDA sniper? Those were his words?" "Those were his words." "He was that sure about a BDA connection?" "Absolutely positive. You have doubts about it?" "I have doubts about everything connected with this case." We'll know more as soon as Garrett pulls the bullet out of the woodwork. It's taking extra time because we're trying to preserve as much of the entry channel as we can. Gurney looked over at the tech in the flower bed, his coveralls hanging loosely over his tall, gangly frame. He was up to his knees in purple alliums and evening primrose, which Gurney recognized as two of Madeline's favorites, along with bee balm and foxglove. Torres went on. We figured the shot had to have come from up there. He gestured toward a broad area of houses several blocks up the hill. I have four of our guys up there now doing door-to-doors, trying to find out if anyone heard or saw anything. Somebody up there must have heard the gunshot, even if it was suppressed, which I guess it was, or some of the neighbors down here would have heard it, and nobody did. Gurney recalled that the police canvassing of the Grinton neighborhood for information at the time of the Steele shooting hadn't produced much cooperation. But Bluestone was a different kind of place, the kind where cops were viewed as allies, not enemies.
Got it.
With a satisfied smile, the tech in the flower bed was holding up what appeared to be a remarkably intact bullet. Gurney and Torres stepped under the tape and went over for a closer inspection.
Looks identical to the one you dug out of the tree in Willard Park, said Torres.
Yep, same caliber, same full metal jacket, no significant deformation, nice and clean for ballistics.
He slipped the bullet into a small evidence envelope, already labeled and dated.
Great work, said Torres. Thank you.
So that's the whole deal here, right? Just the bullet recovery, no combing the site?
Nothing here to comb for. We'll be in touch when we find the shooter site.
The tech got into his van and departed. Gurney, followed by Torres, headed for the hole in the woodwork. After giving it a quick examination, he took out his pen and inserted it as far as it would go, about 3 inches below the surface. The range of vectors created by the angle of the pen substantially reduced the portion of the hillside that Torres had originally indicated as the area from which the shot had come. Even allowing for the imprecision of the method and the possibility of the bullet channel being skewed one way or the other by contact with the victim or by the grain of the wood, it narrowed the area of interest to a couple of dozen hillside houses. As Gurney was removing his pen from the channel, Torres's phone rang. He took the call and mostly listened, eyes widening with excitement.
Okay, I got it. 38 Poulter Street. We'll be right there.
He grinned at Gurney.
We may have lucked out. Uniforms found a couple of homeowners who say they heard something that could have been a shot coming from a vacant house that sits between them. Let's roll.
They got into the Crown Vic and 3 minutes later were parked behind two WRPD cruisers at the Poulter Street address. It was a street of two-story colonials on modest plots of land with driveways leading to detached garages. Most of the front yards consisted of neatly trimmed lawns with a few azaleas or rhododendrons in mulched planting beds. The exception was number 38, where overgrown grass, wilted shrubs, and lowered blinds created an impression of abandonment. The open garage door was the only indication of recent use. Two patrol cops with yellow tape were turning the house, garage, driveway, and backyard into a restricted area. A third officer, a heavy-shouldered, thick-necked young man with a shaved head and a stolid expression, was emerging from the neighboring house on the left. Gurney and Torres met him in front of the driveway. Gurney learned his name was Bobby Bascom when Torres introduced them. He pointed back to the house he'd come from.
A lady in that house, Gloria Fenwick, says she heard a car pulling into this driveway earlier this afternoon.
She know the time? Asked Torres.
Not when it pulled in, but she knows it pulled out at exactly 3:36, and she knows it was a black Corolla sedan and the driver was in a hurry.
She's that sure about the time and car model?
She's sure about the car because she has an old Corolla herself. She's sure about the time because it was unusual for anyone to come to that house, so when she heard a car pulling in, she went to her side window trying to see who it might be. She couldn't see anyone because the car was already in the garage, but she stayed by the window. A few minutes later, she heard a loud bang, which she thought was a door slamming. Maybe 30 seconds after that, the car came backing out of the garage onto the street, and, as she put it, peeled rubber and was gone. That got her attention. That's when she looked at the clock.
She get a look at the driver?
No,
but she said it had to be a man because women don't drive that fast.
Did you call in a description of the car?
Yep, they've put an APB out on it.
Torres called headquarters and told them to add the plate number of the car associated with the Steele shooting to the APB on the black Corolla in Bluestone.
He resumed his debriefing of Bascom. Does the lady know anything about the people who own this house?
She said they moved to Florida 6 months ago. They weren't able to sell the house before they left, so they put it up for rent.
She know anything about the renters?
Just that she's never seen them, but a friend in the real estate business told her it was someone from down in Grinton.
How'd she feel about that?
Bascom shrugged.
About like you'd expect. Grinton is not a popular word on this side of town.
How about the neighbor on the other side?
Hollis Bitter, piece of work, pissed off at the grass not being mowed, pissed off at the Grinton element moving into Bluestone, pissed off at gun control faggots. A lot of things piss him off.
Has he ever seen the people who rented the house?
No, but he thinks they must be foreigners.
Why?
Some bullshit about them not cutting the grass.
It wasn't making a lot of sense.
Jesus, muttered Torres.
Did he tell you anything that could be relevant to the case?
Actually, yes, and that part's more interesting. Like the lady on the other side, he heard a sharp bang, but he didn't get to the window right away. Says he was locked in the shitter.
Locked?
That's the word he used.
The point is the window was open, and he's sure what he heard leaving wasn't a car. He says it was a motorcycle, and that the sound didn't come from the street. It came from the weedy little hill that drops off in back of these houses.
Torres looked uncertain. Do we trust what he says about the sound?
Bascom sucked at his teeth.
I kind of pushed him on that, and he said he used to be a motocross mechanic down at Dortler's Speed Sports.
Torres appeared puzzled by the conflicting vehicle descriptions.
We'll have to get that sorted out. Right now we need Garrett up here, and we need to get into that house. I'll call in a request for a search warrant.
If you want to, for the record, said Gurney. But we have justification to go in immediately, and we have reason to believe a shot was fired from the premises, and we have to ensure that the evidence techs aren't blindsided when they go in, which they need to do ASAP.
Torres made the warrant call, then a call to Garrett Felder, the head crime scene tech.
Okay, he said, putting away his phone. Let's do it.
How many doors does that house have?
Three, said Bascom. Front, back, and left side.
Torres looked questioningly at Gurney.
Your show, Mark. Put us where you want us.
Right, okay. You take the back. Bobby, you take the side. I'll take the front and give the signal for going in.
One of the two cops taping off the area looked over.
You want us somewhere?
Torres thought about it for a moment, then pointed.
Go to the diagonal corners of the yard so you can each see two sides of the house and keep an eye on the windows.
They nodded and went to their assigned positions. Bascom, Gurney, and Torres did the same. As Gurney was passing the side door, he noted that it was slightly ajar. The back door, he discovered a few seconds later, was wide open. He reached down to his ankle holster, pulled out his Beretta, slipped off the safety, and waited for the entry signal. A moment later, he heard Torres's knocking at the front door, a pause, then more insistent knocking, followed by,
"Police, open the door now!"
Then several seconds of silence, followed by,
"Officers going in, now!"
and the sound of glass breaking. Gurney stepped through the open back doorway into a narrow hall that led past a small bathroom into a stale-smelling kitchen. The layout was similar to that of the Steel House, but everything here was duller, dustier. He passed through the kitchen into a small dining room, separated from the living room by a wide arch. In the living room there were no rugs, one flimsy-looking floor lamp and very little furniture, a shabby couch, an armchair, an end table, adding to the uninhabited feeling. In the dim light coming through the partially closed blinds, he could see a stairway to the second floor. A hall behind the stairway led to the side door. He assumed that the door he saw beneath the stairway would lead to the basement. Torres was at the foot of the stairs to the second floor, his Glock in a two-handed grip close to his chest. Bascom was in the hall, a similar weapon in a similar position. Torres called out,
"This is the police! Anyone in the house? Show yourself now!"
The response was a dead silence. In a low voice, he directed Bascom to check out the basement and asked Gurney to come with him to check out the upstairs. There was no carpet on the stairs, and the creaking of each tread was sufficient to give anyone who might have been lurking up there a step-by-step sense of their approach. The upstairs turned out to be as bleak and deserted as the downstairs. There were three bedrooms, each containing a double bed. There was a bathroom with a dusty bathtub, a shower stall with no shower curtain, and a towel rack with no towels. The bedroom that attracted Gurney's attention was facing the rear of the house,
The bed and chair had been pushed out of the way against a side wall. The window was open. Enough afternoon sunlight was slanting in to reveal three dime-sized impressions on the dusty floor. From the doorway, Gurney could see through the open window several blocks away, and lower on the hill a row of modest homes. The front yard of one was cordoned off with yellow tape. A few of the local residents were still gathered in the street, like fans lingering at an athletic field after the players have gone home. Now that the dismal house at 38 Poulter Street had been identified with reasonable certainty as the second sniper site, the collection and protection of trace evidence became a priority. So it was no surprise that Garrett arrived with help. The surprise was the package the help came in. A short, stout woman he introduced as Shelby Towns, whose head was shaved as clean as Bobby Bascom's. She had silver studs in her lips, nostrils, and ears. She was wearing a black T-shirt with the word Gender Bender emblazoned in white letters across her ample chest. Perhaps to defend her getup, Torres told Gurney that Shelby was involved in a long-term undercover assignment, but that her dual college degrees in forensic science and chemistry made her an ideal part-time addition to high-priority crime scene examinations. Gurney filled her and Garrett in on the layout of the house and what he'd seen in the upstairs bedroom. Bascom mentioned Gloria Fenwick's report of a car and Hollis Vitter's report of a motorcycle. Torres added that it was strange to find in the bedroom floor dust indications of another rifle support tripod, apparently like the first. "Why throw the first tripod in the river and keep the rifle?" he mused aloud to no one in particular. "If the shooter was going to get caught with one or the other, it's the rifle that would nail him." Torres directed Bobby Bascom and the other two cops at the scene to canvass the neighborhood for witnesses to the arrival or departure of a car or motorcycle, and for any information concerning the renters. Then he called headquarters and asked someone to look into city, county, and law enforcement records concerning ownership, tenancy, tax payments, liens, complaints, or anything else they could uncover relevant to the use of the property. Meanwhile, Garrett and Shelby donned disposable coveralls, booties, gloves, and caps. They gathered their special lights, chemicals, and evidence processing paraphernalia from their van and headed into the house. Torres suggested that while the techs were going about their business, he and Gurney should re-interview the two immediate neighbors to see if they recalled anything beyond what they'd already reported to Bascom. Gurney agreed, and Torres volunteered to talk to Gloria Fenwick in the house on the left. Gurney approached the house on the right. He wanted to hear more about the departure of that motorcycle. He hoped that Hollis Vitter's questionable mental state hadn't skewed his perceptions to the point of uselessness. The house was of a size and style similar to number 38. The front lawn was bisected by a neat slate path that led to the front door. Centered in the square of lawn on each side of the path was a small spruce. The driveway had recently been swept clean. The garage door was open, revealing the back end of a military-style Hummer from the early 90s. A Confederate flag decal covered the rear window. When Gurney was still a good 10 yards from the house, the front door opened and a heavy-set, balding man in camo fatigue came out, holding a Rottweiler on a short leash. Gurney figured that the vehicle, the flag, the fatigues, and the dog added up to an exaggerated need to project a don't-mess-with-me image. Gurney produced a polite smile. "Mr. Vitter?" "Who's asking?" He held up his credentials. "Dave Gurney, Office of the District Attorney. I need to speak to you about events in the house next door to you." "You ever hear of the broken window theory of policing?" he asked in an angry voice. Gurney was thoroughly familiar with it, a highly confrontational approach to minor incidents in high-crime neighborhoods from his NYPD days. Every cop in America knew something about it. Many departments had tried it, and the results remained a subject of controversy and heated debate. "I know what it is, sir. Does it have some relevance to the situation next door?" Vitter pointed to the weedy, foot-high grass. "You see that?"
"I see it. What about it?"
Vitter's eyes narrowed.
"The broken window approach says you guys need to address the little signs of big problems. Infringements."
He articulated the words slowly, with drawn-out distaste.
"The idea is zero tolerance. Send a message. What's wrong with the world today is that all the little crap is ignored, swept under the table. Nobody wants to take on the minority bullcrap, the sensitivities.
the political correctness that's murdering us. He waved a finger at Gurney.
You gotta squash the little crap so they understand they can't get away with the big crap. We ought to do what they do other places. Shoot them. Why not? Shoot the scumbags. Shoot the drug dealers. Leave the bodies where they fall. Same with terrorists. Leave them where they fall. Send a message.
Gurney waited to be sure the spiel had run its course.
Mr. Vitter, I have a question for you.
The man cocked his head to the side.
Yeah. Earlier this afternoon, did you hear a motorcycle leaving the property next door?
Vitter's demeanor brightened.
Motocross. Small displacement. High compression, something like a Yamaha dual sport.
That's a guess, but I'm a good guesser.
You saw it?
No need to.
I told you a fellow with the shaved head I was taking a shit, but I have a good ear. Nothing I don't know about bikes, including how they sound.
When you heard it, did you happen to notice the time?
I don't keep a clock of the shitter.
Any idea who it might have been? He looked from side to side and lowered his voice.
Probably one of them.
Them? Infiltrators. They come into our country illegally and disappear into ordinary American life. They stay there, looking around, waiting until they get the word to launch a terrorist attack. You don't hear about this on the regular news. It's all hushed up.
Gurney paused. Have you ever seen anyone next door?
Never, he said, giving the word a fraught significance.
Gurney recognized that familiar quirk of the mind that can transform a lack of evidence into the most convincing evidence of all. In a computer program, that logic circuit would be a disabling flaw. In people, however, it was amazingly common. Gurney thanked the man for his time and headed back to the Crown Vic to wait for Torres and the text to appear. He checked the time on his phone and saw that more than an hour had passed since he dropped Heather off at the emergency room. He assumed that Rick Loomis, if he were still alive, would likely be in one of the operating rooms. If he were a very lucky man, he might be having the side of his head reassembled in a way that would make his life livable. Heather would probably be in one of the waiting rooms, sitting, standing, pacing, besieging every passing nurse and doctor for news about what was happening. Gurney had questions he needed to ask her, but was hesitant to ask, since none of them could compare in weight to the unknowns facing her at that moment. Still, on countless occasions in his homicide career, the need for timely information had forced him to interview people in emotional pain. He'd always hesitated before plunging in, but in the end he always came to the same conclusion, that the need for information trumped the potential disturbance his questions might cause. He got the hospital's number from the internet, called it, explained who he needed to reach, was transferred three times, was put on hold for several minutes, and was about to give up when Heather was finally brought to the phone.
Hello? Her voice sounded thin and exhausted. This is Dave Gurney. How is Rick?
He's in surgery. They can't tell me anything yet.
In the background, Gurney could hear a series of little dings, a sound that brought back memories of ICU monitors, injured cops, long vigils in hospital corridors. I need to ask you a couple of questions. Is that all right?
Go ahead.
When I went to the diner to meet Rick, they told me he'd called to say he'd be late. Do you know why?
I think he checked with someone, maybe to ask about meeting with you, something like that.
You have any idea who it was?
No. But I think whoever Rick was talking to wanted to come with him to your meeting, but he had to take care of something first. And then Rick was going to pick him up. I'm sorry. I wasn't paying much attention.
Her voice was stifled by a little sob. It's okay, Heather.
I don't know what else I can tell you about that.
What you've told me is very helpful. I was just wondering. You referred to the person Rick was talking to as him. Are you sure that the person Rick talked to was a man?
I don't really know. It never occurred to me that it might not be a man.
Do you know if the person was a police officer? She hesitated.
I don't think so.
Why not?
Rick's voice? There's a certain way he talks to other cops. I think this sounded different.
That's a good observation, Heather. I know this is a frightening time for you, and I appreciate your willingness to talk to me.
I want to help you. I appreciate what you did, the risk you took, getting in Judd Turlock's face like that to bring me here when you didn't even know my name.
Her voice was starting to quaver.
Most people wouldn't do that. Something like that. It takes more than courage. It takes goodness.
A brief silence fell between them.
It was broken by Gurney, clearing his throat and trying to speak in a matter-of-fact way. Turlock and other WRPD people will be questioning you about what happened today. Not just about the shooting itself, but I know how the process works. Are you going to tell them that Rick was on his way to meet me when he was shot?
No.
Or that he and I had spoken on the phone?
No.
He paused. You really don't trust the department, do you?
No, I don't.
Do you know if Rick or John Steele had uncovered any evidence of criminal actions?
I think they were getting close.
Was anyone helping them?
Rick didn't like to bring those details home, but I did have the impression that someone was giving them information, telling them which cases they should look into.
Someone inside the department?
Rick never said.
Do you know if it was information about individuals who'd been framed?
I think so.
Framed by Turlock?
Probably. He seems like an awful man.
And Beckert? She hesitated.
Probably not directly. According to Rick, he's the sort of person who makes everything turn out the way he wants, without leaving his fingerprints on anything.
I was told he has political ambitions. Do you know anything about that?
No, but I'm not surprised. He has that kind of...
She let out a sharp little cry.
Have to go. The doctor's here.
He felt a sudden tightness in his chest, perhaps a contagious germ of her fear. He hoped with all his heart she'd be able to handle whatever the doctor was about to tell her. He was just slipping the phone back in his pocket when a call arrived from Sheridan Klein. He was tempted to let it go to voicemail, but he knew that delaying the conversation would accomplish nothing, that procrastination only increased the weight of things that needed to be done. Gurney here?
What on earth is going on?
Is there a problem?
I was told that you barged into the Loomis crime scene and removed a key witness before she could be interviewed by a senior WRPD officer.
That's an interesting arrangement of the facts. Let me give you another one. I narrowly averted a public relations disaster that would have had Beckert stumbling all over himself at his next press conference.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
It means that the desperate wife of a downed police officer was being detained, kept from her possibly dying husband, for the interviewing convenience of a deputy police chief with the sensitivity of a stone. How do you think Beckert's precious media would react to that? Klein took so long to reply, Gurney began to wonder if they were still connected.
That's not the way I heard it, he finally said, the energy gone from his voice. And according to the hospital, Loomis is still alive. I understand the shooter's site has been located and Garrett Felder's going over it, is that right?
Yes.
And the Loomis shooter used the same black Corolla used in the Steele case?
Maybe.
Maybe.
One neighbor saw the Corolla, another neighbor claims there was another vehicle present, an off-road motorcycle. Hard to say at this point which one the shooter used.
What difference does it make? He obviously used one of them. From what you're saying, it appears that he had some kind of BDA backup.
Maybe.
I don't see as how there's any maybe about it. Two vehicles, one shooter, plus one backup.
Gurney remained silent. There were other possibilities, but he didn't feel like discussing them with Klein. At least not until he had a chance to think them through.
Did you observe the site yourself? Asked Klein.
I did.
And?
Similar to the first. Some indication that a rifle support tripod was used. I'm waiting to see what else Garrett and his assistant come up with.
Good.
Would that same Corolla involved any prints they find ought to corroborate the evidence we've gathered on the Steele shooting, which is already a prosecutor's dream? As long as you don't think about it too much, or start wondering why.
What are you talking about?
Why that laser dot followed the back of Steele's head as long as it did? Why he was shot while he was moving rather than while he was standing still? Why the shooter used a full metal jacket rather than a hollow point? Things like that keep me awake at night. They ought to keep you awake, too.
Nonsense. You're overcomplicating everything.
I thought you wanted my objective view of the case.
I do. Of course I do. But right now the case is coming together in an ideal way. I don't want your obsession with tiny loose ends derailing your thinking or creating problems with White River PD. Stay with the big picture is all I'm saying. Avoid unnecessary disputes. Let's move this investigation to a smooth conclusion.
24. When Torres came out of Gloria Fenwick's house, he filled Gurney in on the few bits of additional information he'd gotten from her.
The Corolla that backed out of the driveway and sped away was, in her words, shamefully dirty. During that year's March and early April snowfalls, the driveway had not been plowed. In the months since the owners had moved away and consigned the place to its current renters, she'd never seen a window open or a light on. Apparently all of the owner's mail was being forwarded, and the renters were receiving none, since the postman, a very nice man, never stopped there. The failure to maintain the property, particularly the failure to mow the grass, was, in her opinion, an insult to the residents of Bluestone and typical of the slovenly ways of the Grinton element. And, Torres concluded, she's absolutely certain about the presence of that car. How sure was the guy on the other side of the house about the motorcycle? Totally. So they're each positive about one vehicle and neither was aware of the second. Strange. Gurney thought about that. Not really. In the sniper house there's a bathroom by the back door and a living room in the front. The Fenwick and Vitter houses have the same basic design. Vitter says he heard the motorcycle, which was in back of the sniper house, through his bathroom window. Gloria Fenwick was at her living room window. The driveway the car used is on her side of the sniper house. They each noticed what they were closest to. Torres looked unconvinced. I get why Vitter might not have heard the car, but motorcycles can be pretty loud. Shouldn't she have heard it? Theoretically. But suppose there was a delay of a minute or two between the car leaving and the motorcycle leaving. I doubt she stayed by her window after the car left. She may even have closed it. If there was another engine sound a couple of minutes later down by that back slope, there's no reason it would have meant anything to her. Wouldn't she have at least heard it? We hear sounds constantly, but unless they have some significance to us, our brains discard them, like a spam filter on email. You probably heard hundreds of sounds earlier today, at home, on your way here, down on Oak Street. But I bet you'd have trouble remembering more than a few of them. Well, that may be true, but... He was interrupted by a contralto voice. Either of you have a little spare time? It was Shelby Towns, the female half of the evidence collection team, speaking as she emerged from the front door of the sniper house, facial studs shining in the afternoon sun, white coveralls concealing her gender-bender T-shirt. Garrett figures he'll be tied up inside for another hour or so, she continued as she approached them. And I need to lay out a search grid in back. Two people working together can do that four times faster than one. How about it? Checking his watch, Torres explained that he was late for a follow-up with the men he'd assigned to canvass the neighborhood. Gurney offered to give her a hand, motivated less by a spirit of helpfulness than by the curiosity he always felt at crime scenes. She pointed to the evidence van. Suit, gloves, booties, right inside the door. You've done this before, right? Before Gurney could answer, Torres said, Jesus, Shell, you're talking to the man who holds the NYPD record for solved homicides. He's probably been at more major crime scenes than everyone in our department put together. He got into the Crown Vic, pulled away from the curb, and was gone. Shelby Towns gave Gurney a look. Is that true? The record for solved homicides? Well, they gave me a medal with those words on it. I have no idea whether it's true. Something about her wide-eyed look made him burst out laughing. Before she could ask what he found so funny, he asked how she wanted to set up the grid. The backyard was only about twice the width of the house, but it was over 100 feet deep, extending back behind both the house and the detached garage. The downward slope beyond that added about 50 feet of weeds and briars between the overgrown lawn and the street below. Working together, they'd managed in half an hour to lay out a string grid composed of nearly 206-foot squares covering the lawn and most of the slope. A careful eyes-to-the-ground walkthrough took another half hour. Their discoveries, photographed by Shelby on her tablet, included tire tracks that indicated a motorcycle with knobby motocross tires had been standing on a patch of grassless soil behind the garage and had subsequently crossed the lawn, descended the slope, and turned onto the lower street, confirming Hollis Vitter's claim. Also behind the garage were boot prints next to the tire marks, and similar prints in the soil at the base of the slope, suggesting that the rider had stopped there, perhaps for passing traffic, before turning onto the street. At the edge of the lawn by the slope, Gurney spotted a Bic pen. Shelby photographed it in situ before he picked it up, careful not to smudge any prints, and placed it in an evidence bag. As he was filling out the required item location date information, his phone was ringing. By the time he got to it, the message was already in voicemail. On playback, it was so broken up it was barely understandable. After listening to it 3 times, he could be sure only that the caller was Heather Loomis, and she wanted him to come to the hospital. The reason was indecipherable, but the urgency was clear. He called back, but just got voicemail. He considered trying to reach her through the hospital number, but changed his mind when he recalled the time-consuming runaround involved in his earlier effort. Assuming he'd end up driving there anyway, he decided to just go. After explaining the situation to Shelby, he jogged the 4 blocks down the hill to where he'd left his car in front of the Loomis house on Oak Street. The groups of neighbors had dispersed. The yellow police tape and the darkened red stain on the grass were the only signs that something unnatural had occurred. He got in the Outback and followed the route he'd taken to the hospital with Heather. The traffic was moving more slowly now, with people coming home from work. It gave him time to think, a mixed blessing at that time of day, nearing dusk, when his concerns seemed to intensify. Near the top of his present list was his worrisome position in the investigation of the Loomis shooting. Revealing that Loomis was shot as he set out to discuss his and John Steele's efforts to probe corruption in the department would likely abort any progress in that direction, and perhaps even expose other individuals to retaliation. On the other hand, the phone company would have records of Loomis's call to Gurney to set up their meeting, and his subsequent call to the diner to change the meeting time. If those records were discovered, and if the waitress identified Gurney, he could be charged with withholding evidence in the investigation of a felony, itself a felony. Complicating his decision was the larger question of whether the attempt on Loomis's life was a calculated effort to keep that meeting from happening, or a mindless shoot-a-cop retaliation for the playground murders. He was pretty sure it was the former. As Gurney got out of the car at the hospital parking lot, he felt for the first time that day a chill in the air. The building's entrance was sheltered under a broad portico. A ram van was parked next to it, and a small crowd had gathered. A media crew was adjusting TV lights around 2 central figures. One, in a short red skirt and white blouse, was the news personality he'd seen on Battleground Tonight. The other, in a crisply tailored blue uniform with gleaming brass buttons, was Del Beckert. A crew member by the open rear doors of the van called out, "Light and sound level's good. Recording and transmitting. You're on." The reporter's expression switched from bitchy boredom to the standard Ram TV expression of concern with the worrisome state of the world. She was holding a wireless microphone. "I'm Stacy Kilbrick at Mercy Hospital in White River, New York, where Detective Rick Loomis is barely hanging on to life after being shot by a sniper in his own front yard, raising the tension in this upstate city to the breaking point. I'm talking to Chief Del Beckert, who just emerged from the hospital. What can you tell us, Chief?" Beckert's face was a picture of rock-solid determination. "First, let me assure everyone that we have the tense situation in White River under control. Second, we're making rapid progress toward the identification and apprehension of the coward who tried to kill this fine officer, a servant of our community, a man with a spotless record. Third, you have my personal assurance that law and order will prevail. To the tiny, deluded minority who incite violence for their own selfish ends, I say this. You will be brought to justice. Finally, I ask for your prayers for the full recovery of Detective Rick Loomis. Thank you." Kilbrick stepped forward to ask a question, but Beckert was already striding away toward a dark blue Ford Explorer idling in the circular drive just beyond the portico. She turned to the camera. "I'm Stacy Kilbrick at Mercy Hospital. I'll be keeping you up to date with developments as they occur. Please, folks, remember to say those prayers." The video lights went out and the bitch face returned. Gurney headed into the hospital lobby. Although the exterior of the building came from the same 1960s manual of bleak design as the police headquarters, the interior had been renovated in accordance with more recent ideas about reducing stress in medical settings through the use of soft lighting, colors, and textures. A gently curved cherry wood welcome desk was staffed by 3 smiling senior citizens. Gurney's welcomer was an elegantly dressed woman with a snow-white permanent and light blue eyes. He told her he'd come to see a patient in the ICU. She regarded him with interest and spoke in a lowered voice. "Are you a police officer?"
"Yes."
"I thought so.
They're restricting access, but you probably know that. The media people are just so... Her voice trailed off in disgust, as though media people were sewage that might seep into the building. She told him that the ICU was on the second floor and gave him directions to the elevator bank, adding with a frown, "Such an awful thing." Stepping out of the elevator on the second floor, he found himself in front of a waist-high partition enclosing an administrative island. On the partition was a sign telling him to turn off his cell phone and other electronic devices before entering the ICU. Behind the island was a nursing station with computer monitors, resuscitation equipment, and rolling IV stands. In a far corner of the station, a grinning cop was chatting up an attractive nurse's aide. At a desk inside the island, a slim young man with short, gelled hair looked up at Gurney. His teal name tag said he was Bailey Laker. "Can I help you?" "I'm here to see Rick Loomis, or Mrs. Loomis." "And you are?" "Dave Gurney. Mrs. Loomis asked me to come." The cop left the nurse's aide, his grin fading, and came around to Gurney's side of the island. His shiny brass name tag said he was C.J. Mazurk. "Hello, sir," he said with that assessing look common to cops everywhere. "Who did you say you were?" Gurney presented his ID. He took it, studied it for a long moment, and handed it back. "D.A.'s office?" "Right. Mrs. Loomis is expecting me." "She's down that hall, visitor's area. Turn off your phone." Gurney complied. Halfway along the corridor, there was a room with couches, chairs, and a wall-mounted TV tuned to a weather channel. When he stepped inside, he saw at the far end of the room a sideboard with a coffee machine, and next to it three women sitting at a small table: Heather Loomis, Kim Steele, and Madeline. His surprise at seeing Kim and his wife faded as he recognized a phenomenon he'd witnessed many times: the instinctive support police wives give each other in difficult circumstances. Heather and Kim were already well acquainted, of course, through their husbands, and it had been Madeline's sense of identification with Kim that had solidified his own involvement in the case. He greeted them, then sat in the fourth chair at the table. "There's coffee," said Heather, pointing to the sideboard. "Maybe later. Is there any news about Rick?" "They say he's in stable condition." "Barbiturate-induced coma," said Madeline evenly, "to relieve the pressure on his brain so it can heal, like after my friend Elaine's car accident. She was put in a therapeutic coma for a couple of weeks, and she's perfectly fine today." Heather blinked and managed a small smile. Kim took her hand and held it. A cleaning woman with striking almond-shaped eyes, a dust mask over her mouth and nose, and a name tag identifying her as Shalice Creel came into the room pushing a janitorial cart. She steered it through the obstacle course of couches and chairs to the sideboard, emptied its waste container into one in the base of the cart, and steered her cart back out into the corridor. Heather turned to Gurney. "You got my message?" "It was patchy, but I got enough of it to know you wanted to see me." She reached into her sweatshirt pocket, pulled out an index card, and handed it to him. Scribbled across the middle of the card were some unevenly spaced letters and numbers. TOLDC13111. He examined it for a moment. "What is this?" "It's a message from Rick. When they brought him in from the ambulance and were attaching the monitor things to him, he was trying to speak. They wanted me to see if I could understand what he was saying, but he couldn't get it out. I asked the nurse to get something for him to write on, and she came back with a pen and that index card. I put the pen in his hand, and the card under it on the stretcher. It took him a long time to print those letters, lying on his back, barely conscious, but that's what he wrote." After studying the sequence of characters, Gurney tried one way of grouping them, reading aloud. "2LDC13111. He looked at Heather. "Do the initials LDC mean anything to you, or that number, possibly as an amount of money?" She shook her head. "Suppose we group the opening letters differently. TOLDC13111. She shook her head again. "Maybe we should read the number as individual digits, like a zip code." "It still doesn't mean anything to me." "It has to mean something," said Kim, "something he wanted you to know." It occurred to Gurney that the message might be nothing more than the product of a delirious brain,
but it was clear that Heather and Kim wanted it to be important, and he wasn't going to deflate that hope.
"May I take this with me?" he asked Heather. She nodded.
"I think Rick may have intended it for you."
"I pray to God you get the bastard who shot him," said Kim.
Her eyes were welling with angry tears. Her emotion led to a silence. Finally, Heather spoke up in a controlled voice.
"Del Beckert was here."
"What did he want?" asked Gurney.
"At first, to pretend that he cared about Rick."
"And then?"
"He wanted to know how many phones Rick had."
Gurney had a sinking feeling. "What did you tell him?"
"I told him Rick had a department-issued BlackBerry, an iPhone, and our house phone."
"Did he want to know anything else?"
"He asked if Rick had any contact with individuals from the Black Defense Alliance, or from that other one, whatever it's called, White Men for Black Justice. Their spokesman keeps popping up on those programs where everybody yells at each other. Corey Payne, I think that's his name. He hates the police."
"And you said?"
"I said Rick kept his police work to himself. Then Beckard told me that the other shot..."
She hesitated, glancing at Kim.
"It's all right. Go ahead." "He told me that the shot that hit John Steele came from an apartment linked to a BDA member. And the one that hit Rick may also have come from a house with a BDA link."
Gurney paused, taking this in, before returning to an earlier point. "Those phones you told Beckert about, do you know which of them Rick used for the calls he made to me, or to the diner, or to the person who wanted to come to the meeting we were supposed to have?"
"None of them. Rick has a fourth phone I didn't mention. An anonymous prepaid one he used for calls about the project he and John were working on."
"Where's that fourth phone now?"
"Rick keeps it hidden. All I know is that it never leaves our house and that he'd never want Beckert to get hold of it."
Gurney felt a sense of selfish relief. That hidden phone was the only hard evidence of his conversation with Loomis. As long as it remained hidden, there was little chance of his being charged with failing to report that conversation. As he was wondering how well hidden it was, a short, brown-skinned man in green hospital scrubs entered the room. A white plastic name tag identified him as P.W. Patel, M.D.
"Mrs. Loomis,"
she turned toward him, her eyes full of fear.
"I don't bring you any bad news," he said in a softly accented voice. "I came only to tell you that in a few minutes we will take your husband to radiology for another brain imaging procedure. The neurosurgeon has requested this. It is a normal request, not a cause for worry. If you and your companions wish to see the patient before he is taken to radiology, this must be done now. You understand?"
Heather nodded.
"Can you tell me if there's been any change in his condition?"
"No change, but this is not bad. With TBI, we must wait and see."
"TBI?
Traumatic brain injury. We wait and monitor intracranial pressure because of damage to the temporal bone structure. Perhaps this will not be a problem since the bullet did not perforate major brain areas, but we wait and watch."
Heather nodded uncertainly.
"Thank you." "You are welcome, Mrs. Loomis. Perhaps not too far away there can be good news. But now, if you wish to see your husband for a few minutes..."
"Yes, I understand."
After he left the room, Madeline asked Heather,
"Do you want us to come with you?"
She blinked in confusion.
"Yes. I don't know. Yes, come."
She stood up and headed out of the room, seemingly unaware of banging her shin on the corner of a low coffee table. They followed her, Kim, Madeline, and Gurney in that order, into the corridor and past the nursing station, where the cop and the nurse's aide had resumed their conversation. Behind the nursing station, they came to a row of patient enclosures with sliding glass doors. At the center of each enclosure was a high-tech hospital bed surrounded by monitoring equipment. Only one enclosure was occupied. The four visitors gathered outside it in the single-file order in which they'd come down the hall. From where Gurney stood, all he could see of the patient in the bed was a massive bandage covering his head, an oxygen mask covering most of his face, and a web of wires and tubes connecting him to the bedside machines. He looked vulnerable and anonymous. A tall nurse approached Heather.
"You know the routine here, but I'll repeat it for your friends. Please do not touch anything beyond those glass doors. Especially do not touch the patient or the devices connected to him. The sensors are sensitive. The alarms go off easily. Are we all okay with this?" Heather answered for everyone. Of course, thank you. Leaning toward her, the nurse spoke softly. I've seen folks in worse shape than your husband come through just fine. Heather opened the sliding glass door and went to her husband's side. Kim followed part of the way, stopping inside the doorway. Madeline remained outside. Gurney stood behind her. The intensity of Heather's focus on Rick began to make Gurney feel out of place. It soon appeared to have the same effect on Kim, who backed out of the enclosure. She whispered to Madeline, "Maybe we should let her be alone with him?" Madeline nodded her agreement. Just then they saw Heather bending over the bed, the tip of her forefinger touching the back of Rick's hand. "I'm here with you," she said gently. "I'm right here beside you." As Gurney was leaving the ICU, he noted that the cop and the nurse's aide were still very much involved with each other. He stopped by the corner of the nursing station. "Excuse me, officer. Over here, please." The cop stared at him. "Now, please." The nurse's aide raised an eyebrow and stepped away, saying something about making her rounds. The cop's stare got chillier as he approached Gurney. "What's up?" "I assume you're here to protect Rick Loomis. Do you have any idea what you're protecting him from?" "What's that supposed to mean?" "You think you're here to prevent unauthorized media intrusions, make sure no reporters get in, or try to take pictures, or try to talk to Loomis. Is that about right?" His eyes narrowed. "What's your point?" "My point is that the media idiots are the least of your problems. There's something about the shooting you need to know. The public version is that Loomis was shot by black radicals because he's a cop, but the fact is he may have been shot for another reason, by someone who wanted him dead, not just any cop, but him in particular. If that's true, there may be another attempt on his life. It could happen soon, and it could happen here." "Where the hell are you getting this from?" "That doesn't matter. What matters is that you understand what's at stake here." The cop pursed his lips and nodded with obvious skepticism. "What was your name again?" Gurney repeated his name. "Pass along what I told you to whomever relieves you. They need to understand what they're here for." The expression on the cop's face gave Gurney the feeling that his comments might or might not get passed along to the next shift, but they'd surely get to Judd Turlock. Gurney left the ICU and headed for the visitor's lounge. When he got there, he found Madeline waiting for him in the corridor. Kim was inside, sitting on one of the couches. Madeline led him away from the open doorway and spoke in a low voice. "Is there anything else you need to do here?" He shrugged. "I've done all I can for the moment, which isn't much. How about you?" "Heather wants to stay here overnight. Kim wants to stay with her. I think that's what I should do, too."
"Stay here in the ICU?"
"There's a facility here on the grounds. The Mercy Visitors Inn, for family and friends of patients. It just feels right to be with them."
"You want me to stay?"
"I'd like that. But I think Heather and Kim would rather you were off somewhere investigating, discovering the meaning of Rick's note."
"Isn't tomorrow one of your days at the clinic?"
"I'll call Jerry tonight. If she can't cover for me herself, she'll get someone." She touched his cheek. "Drive safely. I'll call you if anything changes."
He made no move to leave. She cocked her head and gave him a long sideways look.
"There's something you're not saying. What is it?"
"I'd rather you weren't staying here."
"Why?"
"I think there's a possibility of a second attempt on Loomis's life."
"Here?"
"It's possible."
"Is it likely?"
"I don't know. The possibility scares me. It's not a situation I want you to be in."
She uttered a little one-syllable laugh and shook her head. "God knows I've been in worse situations more than a few times. When we were running the abused women's shelter at the clinic, we were getting horrendous threats all the time. And then there was that other little matter of the firebombing when someone thought we were resettling refugees, remember that?"
"Still,
the possibility you're talking about isn't going to convince Heather or Kim to leave. I feel strongly that staying with them is the right thing for me to do."
"Then I really should..." She cut him off.
"Don't even think about staying here for something that iffy. You've committed yourself to the investigation. Go do your job, and I'll do mine. I'm serious. People are relying on you. We'll be fine here. I'll make sure that Romeo out there keeps his eyes open for strangers and off the nurses.
He reluctantly agreed, wishing he felt better about it. She kissed him on the cheek. 25. A nearly invisible drizzle began shortly after he pulled out of the hospital parking lot, requiring only a single swipe of the wiper blades every minute or two. The blades needed replacing, having developed a stuttering squeak that kept intruding into his thoughts. On the section of the interstate between White River and Gurney's exit, there was virtually no traffic. On the winding road from there to Walnut Crossing, there was none. For most of the drive, he'd been turning Rick's message over in his mind, with the assumption that it meant something and wasn't just the equivalent of someone talking in his sleep. But whatever that sequence, TOLDC13111, might signify, it continued to elude him. It had the appearance of a coded communication, but it seemed a far reach to imagine that a barely conscious man who'd just taken a bullet in the head would have the presence of mind required to encode something. And even if he did, for whom would it be intended? John Steele was dead, and the code meant nothing to Heather. But if it wasn't a code, what was it? An abbreviation would be one possibility. If he were having a hard time writing, shortening the message as much as he could would make sense. But an abbreviation of what? And which letters were attached to which? Did the message begin to LDC? Or was it told C? Did the following number represent a dollar amount, an address, a quantity of something? Gurney was getting nowhere as he turned onto the road that led to his property, so he decided to put the issue aside. Perhaps later he'd be able to see whatever he was missing now. He parked next to the old farmhouse. He went inside, got some carrot soup and salmon out of the refrigerator and put the soup in a pot to warm it. He went into the bedroom to exchange his sport jacket, button-down shirt and slacks for a well-worn flannel shirt and faded jeans. Then he donned his old rain slicker and headed out to the chicken coop. The hens were already up on their perch. He checked the nesting boxes for eggs, checked the levels of chicken feed and water, and redistributed some straw that had gotten pushed into a corner. On his return to the house, he stopped at the asparagus patch. Using the miniature jackknife attached to his key ring, he harvested a handful of spears, brought them in, and stood them in a mug with some water in the bottom to keep them fresh. After hanging his slicker to dry, he put his soup in a bowl and his salmon on a plate, and brought them both to the table. As he was eating, his mind returned to the cryptic jottings on the index card. This time, instead of asking which letters and numbers might belong together, he asked himself what sort of information the man might have been trying to convey. If Loomis believed he was dying, he might have wanted to leave a love note for Heather. Gurney imagined that if he himself were dying, letting Madeline know he loved her would be the only thing that mattered. But if Loomis's sense of his condition was less than fatal, what might he want the people close to him to know? Perhaps the identity of the individual who shot him. Perhaps the identity of the person he was going to bring to his meeting with Gurney. Perhaps both of the above, especially if they were one and the same. In that context, told C13111 might be a shortened version of I told C13111 about my planned meeting with Dave Gurney. But how could those characters be read as someone's name? The thought occurred to him that they might be an ID number, perhaps belonging to a White River police officer. But then he recalled that Mark Torres's badge number had three digits followed by three letters. So if it was an ID number, what organization did it belong to? Gurney had no answer. In fact, he had the feeling it was the wrong question. As for the possibility that the initial C might refer to the individual and 13111 be his zip code, that seemed such an unlikely way to describe a person he would have dismissed it without another thought, except that the number did fall within the range of zips for upstate New York. He recalled that he was about to check its location when he was at the ICU, but couldn't because of the cell phone prohibition. He realized his phone had been turned off ever since. He picked it up and turned it on. It told him he'd received three voice messages in the past 28 minutes. The first was from Sheridan Klein, the second from Madeline, and the third from Dr. Walter Thrasher. He decided to listen to Madeline's first. Hi, hon. Kim and I just checked in to the visitor's inn.
Heather is still over at the ICU waiting for them to bring Rick back from radiology. We're going to pick her up in a little while and get some